Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Happy
not Fran
Drescher. Happy Mama's Day
too.
2 days ago. Happy Mama's Day to all the mommies out there.
Yes, it was a great day. What
was
about
it?
For you? Yeah.
We did the step family thing. I have to tell you that I'm not going to say the name because I don't like to give people bad publicity, but the restaurant we went to was so ungodly expensive. I didn't pay for it.
Really?
Yes, my
was it like, it was a brunch?
It was a brunch.
Yeah.
The food was not that great.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't even a champagne or a mimosa included in it, and it was like a lot of money.
Really?
I couldn't believe it. It's not even that elegant. It's just right there in Brentwood.
Oh,
so,
that's upsetting.
I'm not
going to
say the name. But but the company was wonderful. We had a good time, and then we went out afterwards. Do you know where the Stone House is?
No.
Okay, so it's in Westlake Village. It's this outdoor... It's in Westlake Village, and it is an outdoor like winery, and you know, it's right there in the heart of Westlake Village,
cool.
And it's so pretty. I mean, they have vines, it's outdoors, they have fire pits, and
that's so much fun.
So we had a glass of wine, and we just kind of chilled.
Well, that's so
and that
cool.
Was good. Yes,
that's nice.
Yeah,
I went to a Korean spa.
Can I
please talk about this experience?
Yes, you can.
It was insane. So I've been before. But it's been a while. Like, everywhere you look, left, right, boobs, like, every which way. Like, it was like a United Colors Benetton ad. Like, every ethnicity, every, like, you know, which way. And then I'm, like, laying on the table, like, they're giving me a scrub. And she's, like, flipping me over like a dead fish. Like, it was just, like, a crazy. But I loved it. I loved it because I felt like I was in a different world.
Did you feel good afterwards? Like,
yes,
your body
my
actually
skin
feel
was
more...
like a baby's tushy. It was great. I had a great time. So it was a very good. My mom is, like, the exact opposite. Like, she would be, like that would be the last place on earth that she'd want to go. So it's, like, you have to be that kind of person that's, like, cool with that. And, you know, I loved it. And
I'm so proud of you because I know so many moms that feel guilty if they don't spend Mother's Day with their kids, but to some degree it's supposed to be do what you want to do. You are the mama to be celebrated.
Exactly.
You know? So hubbies, you know, grab the kids and let mama do her thing.
That's exactly it. No guilt.
We always do that for the dads.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Go off and golf. I'll handle the kids.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh my. Okay.
So I'm sorry about my voice, by the way. I really, it's awful.
It's the sexy raspy voice.
It's a phone sex operator.
Oh yeah, there
you
go.
I'll go with that. No, it's like a Fran Drescher. That's like what I think of because it's so nasally, so I apologize. All right.
So, last week. Yeah.
Daniel Keating, born anxious.
He wasn't born anxious. But he wrote the book, Born Anxious.
But very interesting.
Very interesting. And I like the way he writes, and it was just a really...
Very bright and articulate guy.
Very articulate. Yeah. So he was awesome. Yeah.
So if you missed that show, you can tune in to iTunes and hear that, all about anxiety and whether it's inherited and all that good stuff. And he gave some really good tips about how to be less anxious also.
Absolutely.
So it was really helpful.
Yeah, very helpful. And if you do want to give us a call, you can at 323-203-0815. We have an in-studio guest today, which is always very exciting, except the print on here is too small. Would you read it, please, Kelly?
Oh, my God. That is so funny. I'm so sorry. I'll do the font bigger next time. Okay, so we have Dr. Beth Leadham. I hope I'm saying that right. Okay, good. She's a licensed psychologist and certified sex therapist. She earned her PhD from USC and completed her clinical internship at UCLA's Psychiatric Hospital. She served on the faculties of USC, UCLA, and the Chicago School of Professional Psychologies. She's worked with a wide range of clients, from religiously orthodox couples to clients with a wide range of sexual difficulties to people who are kinky, non-monogamous, or who are sex workers and adult performers. She works with individual adults, couples, and groups of adults, such as polyamorous groups. Very cool. She writes and gives talks frequently on a range of sex-related topics. In addition to her private practice, Dr. Leadham is the president of the Los Angeles County Psychological Association.
Welcome,
Thank
Dr. Bennett.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. It's nice to be here.
And as we were saying, this is the first time I've really seen you in person.
I know. I've known you and stalked you for years.
Yes, exactly.
we've had an email and phone relationship and a Skype relationship.
Yes, but now you're here in person, yes, which is exciting. And your practice is in Encino.
Encino, and I have a secondary office out in Agoura Hills where I'm once a week.
Oh, cool. Yeah, because I have one in Thousand Oaks. Yeah, neat. Oh, awesome. Okay, so we just got to dive in.
Oh, my
here.
God. I have so many questions. I'm filming at the mouth. So many. Okay, so I want to know, like, kind of what the typical scenario is when people come in. Like, what do they typically call you for? I mean, I'm sure you get a range, but...
In my practice in general?
Yeah.
Well, the probably number one thing that sex therapists see is a desire discrepancy. That's a discrepancy in a couple... between one partner who has a high level of desire and one partner who has a lower level of desire.
And, like, what do you do in that situation? Like,
yeah,
if you're mismatched, like, is there an easy answer?
Sometimes there's an easy answer and sometimes there isn't. It's interesting because a lot of times I get couples in and they say they're coming in to have sex therapy and they have a sexual problem. Uh-huh. But once you do a little bit of digging, you realize that the sex issue is really just the canary in the coal mine issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that actually it's masking or maybe just a signal of deeper issues.
Sure.
Primarily resentment, I think, is the number one. It's like kryptonite for a relationship, and it's certainly not good... not a good aphrodisiac.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
No. And, I also find that with some of the people that I work with in that issue is that particularly if somebody had been molested or raped as a child and they don't have desire, it's like it's impossible to ask them to, well, you know what? It's your husband. It's not that. Just have more sex, because then they feel like really violated again.
Right. And then there's a reenactment of the original trauma. Absolutely.
Right. And then the poor guy, if it is the guy, you know, it's like, well, I'm not trying to do that. I'm not trying to hurt you. I just want to love you and be with you. But then it activates that. And then he feels deprived.
Well, it's a terrible position for him to be in, too.
Yeah.
For both of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, my. Kelly and I have an ongoing debate. We think we're more on the same page now, but I don't know about pornography.
Yes.
And its effects on... I'm of the side mostly that porn really destroys relationships more than it helps it, and that it has a lot of repercussions in terms of erectile dysfunction and things like that. So what's your...
Well, that's a great question. There's dysfunctional use of porn, and then there's everybody else. And so I guess you really have to ask yourself if close to 100% of the men in this country are looking at porn. Maybe 97, and the other three are lying.
Right.
Yeah, true.
Other 3% are lying. The vast majority of men are using porn, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of women. And it's interesting that the data show, like the search data show, that more people are using it than actually admit to it in surveys, because people lie about their sex life and about lots of other things on self-report surveys. If that is the case, then you would see if it's destructive to relationships, then you might expect to see more people coming to sex therapy, more people coming to couples therapy, or more marriages breaking up, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the rates of divorce have stayed pretty steady over the last 10 or 15 years as the internet has become more and more popular. So my guess is you may be half right. It may be that in some cases it is very destructive, but there are a whole lot of people who are using it in a healthy way where it's not destructive. So
what would be a healthy way? Both consenting, both know about it, or...
Well, that's a great question. I think that raises the question of whether people have the right or the privilege of having a private sex life that's just with themselves. Or if being in a committed relationship requires complete honesty about everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah.
Kind of depends on the couple, right?
Uh-huh. It depends on the couple.
Some people choose not to know, and others do want to know.
Yeah.
Right. This begins to fall into a category of what I call thought crimes, sexual thought crimes.
Do tell more.
And this is a lot of what I can end up talking about when I'm talking about pornography, because I will often get a couple, and most of the couples I see are heterosexual, so I'm going to use he, she, but obviously that's not the only kind of couple that is out there that comes to my practice. But frequently, the wife in a couple has a fantasy, and I think it's an unrealistic expectation, that her partner is only supposed to be thinking of her, is only supposed to be attracted to her, is only supposed to have sexual fantasies about her. And the poor guy can't even close his eyes during sex because she thinks that maybe he's thinking about somebody else.
Yeah.
And it's just not a reasonable expectation. If you want to have a long marriage, you have to accept that. There's no such thing as a thought crime.
Right.
It's what we do with our thoughts and we do with our impulses that really affects the relationship.
I remember Dr. Ruth saying, you could, you know, think about the whole football team if I care. Like, she was all about, you know.
But a lot of women, at least in my practice, they talk about the use of pornography in their husbands as cheating. It's a form of cheating, that they really feel betrayed. They feel that it's perpetuating an imagery or two-dimensional type of relationship, and then they feel inadequate, and it sets up all this body image crap, and it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, I think that those cases are really interesting, and it's worth exploring. To me, that's just the beginning of the conversation. I think, you know, to deepen that conversation, I would want to know, well, how is your sex life right now? And let's take up the question of whether this is a competition, you know, this is in competition with your sex life, or whether this is something that's completely separate. Listen, every couple has to arrive at their own understanding, and hopefully they're doing it, you know, with honesty and integrity, you know, have a shared understanding of what their agreements are, including the agreement to, to be monogamous, if that's what they're choosing, and what constitutes cheating.
So I was just going to say.
I'll flip before it. Go for it.
Okay, exactly. All right. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about this quote unquote hall pass. I don't know if you've heard about this.
Yeah,
I'm sure you have. Like, if, you know, couples
are... She coined the term. What do you say? Right,
this is our leading sex expert here.
Because there's been a lot of debates, you know, among my, you know, friends, and we've talked about it. And I'm just curious, kind of, your, you know, from your experience, like, is this possible? Does it work? Is it dangerous? And all that good stuff.
You're talking about a couple coming to an agreement that it's okay for them to break their monogamy agreement on occasion.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, it certainly is possible. It's so possible that it was on the cover of the New York Times magazine last weekend. I don't know
if
you saw, there was a whole issue,
a very
long article about polyamory.
Yes.
It was about. But I think you're talking about something else when you say hall pass, right?
Right, exactly. Just like random sort of, okay.
And is it tell or no tell policy with the hall
pass?
That,
I think, is up to the couple.
Okay.
You know? So, I mean, but yeah, curious, like...
You know, I really haven't seen too many people who have tried that. The people I see usually are either considering opening up their relationship, if that's what they're there to talk about, or are dealing with an affair where there was a non-consensual opening up of the relationship, not the kind of hall pass scenario. I do have people in my practice who are swingers or who have open relationships defined variously.
Yes.
You know, there's lots of different ways of defining that.
Right, so it's more swingers that you're kind of seeing.
It's interesting when you think about hall pass. It's like who decides whether it's a kosher hall pass or not? You know, are some candidates for the hall pass okay, and are some not? Right?
Yes. Yeah. It's so true. Right.
Yeah. Right. Like, there's certain people I don't care if Christopher ever has sex with them because they're gross.
And you'd be fine with that. But if she was like a model,
I'm kidding,
right?
Yeah,
yeah.
But why that one?
Right, exactly.
You know, can I go back to the issue of pornography
for
a minute? Because I do want to say, and I do want to land in your court firmly on one issue, Deborah, which is that porn is for adults. However, all of our sons are being exposed to it, and most of our daughters also are very curious about it. And I think that is where it becomes really difficult, because a lot of kids are getting their sex education through pornography.
Yes.
And my mentor, Marty Klein, puts it perfectly. He says, watching pornography and then expecting a sexual interaction to actually go that way is like watching the highlight reel of an entire football season and then showing up at a football game and expecting it to be like that highlight reel.
Or baseball, which is the most boring of them.
You're going to be disappointed.
So true.
And so I think it's a good argument for why, first of all, parents should be engaging in a lot of sex education in an ongoing way and talking about how porn isn't actually real sex.
Right.
It's a highly produced fantasy experience that doesn't bear much of a relationship to what actually goes on.
Uh-huh. And the earlier our children are exposed to it, too, when their brains are developing, it's got to shift some of the synapses in the wrong direction. You know, the pleasure centers and all that. It's sort of like, you know, early drug use and then not really maturing the brain properly.
Well, it's interesting also because it creates some unreasonable expectations about what kind of sexual behaviors people might want to engage in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got two teenage girls, and the things that their male peers expect and fantasize about are stuff that I didn't even know about when I was that age.
Yeah,
yeah, it's very different.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that. Because I mean, it's a very big. It's so highly accessible now, and it's everywhere. And we have to have some relationship with understanding it and how it really does affect us.
It does scare me because I've got two boys.
I know, and I'm like,
oh my god, you know, because you want. Yeah. I mean, it's like once you open your eyes to that, it's scary. I can understand. Like, I feel like I could see it happening at friend's house. It's like, oh my god, you know, look what I discovered, and you know,
yeah, you terrifying. Can control what happens at your house, but not at
not exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm more afraid of. Yeah.
So let's launch into sex addiction, because I think that's I think a lot of people don't really understand what that is, and it can show up in so many different ways. Maybe you can give us a couple of examples.
Well, sure. And let me first talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about the term sex addiction. It's a problematic term, and as you know, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Illness or Mental Disorders is what we base our diagnoses on, and. Mm-hmm. There was a recent revision, the DSM-5, and the reviewers of the DSM who were in the process of revising it decided not to put, they called it hypersexuality, decided not to put it in the DSM because there are problems with the concept. And I can go through a few of them. First of all, I just want to be upfront saying this is a real thing. I mean,
we
all know people whose sexual behaviors have gotten them into terrible trouble and they have lost important relationships and...
Right.
In some cases, landed in jail. So that's definitely a thing. But it's really hard to talk about addiction when you're talking about something that's a basic life drive, right? Mm-hmm. You know, food, air, water, and sex are sort of fundamental to what puts us together as humans. Mm-hmm. So we can't really talk about being addicted to air. And it's a little bit tricky to talk about being addicted to sex, since it is a fundamental drive. It's in a bit of a different category compared to something like alcohol, which we don't require for life or reproduction.
Speak for yourself.
Sorry,
wait, wine? That's not a...
on Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
It's right there.
So I prefer the term compulsive sexual behavior just because I think it's more descriptive.
It makes sense.
Yeah. So one of the things to consider is whether it is actually the behavior that's a problem or whether there's something underlying the behavior that's a problem. So, for example, somebody might be engaging in a lot of sexual behavior that... that he or she feels is appropriate according to their culture, but that might be judged inappropriate from somebody from another culture. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, we're thinking about cultural variables and context when we think about compulsive sexual behavior. The definition can also be tricky. I don't know if you've ever looked at one of those online tests for sex addiction.
Yes.
If you Google sex addiction test, it's going to come
up. More than 11 times a week or blah, blah, blah.
You know, there's a lot of questions and there's some variations, but it's all based on some similar concepts. But it's a pretty, it's a tool that isn't really perfect. Mm-hmm. It's pretty imperfect. So that, for example, some of the items are, have you ever been ashamed of your sexual behavior? Have you ever regretted it? Has it ever caused someone pain? Have you ever tried to stop it? Well, if you think about what it might be like to be a gay person raised in a homophobic culture, you would answer yes to all those questions. Mm-hmm. But the problem isn't the sexual behavior. The problem is the context, right? We're going to take that up.
Mm-hmm. Great point.
Yeah, that was a really good point.
So when I am thinking about problematic sexual behavior, I'm usually thinking in terms of is the sexual behavior that you're doing causing you to keep secrets?
Yeah.
You know, in AA, they say you're only as sick as your secrets. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great litmus test. And that's different from privacy, right? So I don't necessarily talk to my kids about what goes on in my adult life, but that doesn't mean I'm keeping a secret from them. It's just private.
Yeah.
Or you can ask yourself whether you're regretting the behavior afterward. You know, again, with the caveat that culture plays a role in that.
Sure.
Is it interfering with your life? So are you losing evenings or weekends to porn? Mm-hmm. Like somebody who's really got a dependency on porn and is really using porn or sexual behavior, other sexual behavior, in a problematic way is losing time, is maybe jeopardizing work.
Yeah.
And are there other things that are in jeopardy? Maybe are you putting yourself in violation of the law, or are you putting yourself or your partner at medical risk, or are you potentially damaging your relationships? So those kinds of questions, I think, really get at the deeper issues of whether this is truly problematic.
Sure.
I'm trying to think of some real life examples too. Like, you know, on the internet now, you could be on a page and ads come up. You know, it might be some hot girl or, you know, the Victoria's Secret catalog or something. And some gentlemen have described to me that once they see that, they have to go look, and they get deeper and deeper in, and then they've lost half a day at work because they've just become embedded in that whole cycle of, oh, there's more there, and there's more there. And it just becomes this obsession.
Like a rabbit hole.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yes. And but I can see that, you know, that's what the advertisers are trying to do to us too. I mean, it's really,
they serve us up those pretty potent images on purpose.
Absolutely.
No, but I have worked with people who have literally come home from work on Friday and then they lose the entire weekend. They'll take breaks to pee and eat and then go to work on Monday morning, and the entire weekend was porn. And the same kind of thing with sexual behavior too.
Very interesting. And early masturbation and that sort of thing about people, you know, using that as a self-soothing tool as opposed to just for sexual arousal and getting off. Mm-hmm. So that has, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, with most of the things that are pleasurable in life, we use them to soothe ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, macaroni and cheese isn't bad per se. Only if you eat a vat of it.
Wait, I go to Whole Foods almost every day with the little sample cups, and I get a little dollop of mashed potatoes and a little dollop of macaroni and cheese. I figure if I do that for like 360 days, I'll finally burn out of it, but I won't have all the calories in one sitting.
That's funny.
I had to expose myself.
Yeah, so most of these behaviors serve a coping function too. You know, they're not just about sexual pleasure or about reproduction. So I think what you're getting at, though, is it medicating something?
Right. And that can become the compulsion, though, that I have to self-soothe, and that's the only way. And it can interfere with being able to be in a relationship or to be present with your children or be present with your spouse or anybody.
Yeah, and is that coping mechanism taking the place of other healthy things?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I worry about the opposite, that people can be promiscuous and then blame it on, oh, well, I have a sex addiction, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be used as an excuse. This is a disease. It's an illness. And and we see this in the media a lot, too, where it feels like there's an abdication of responsibility. But real sex addiction treatment, and there are some places that really do excellent treatment for this kind of thing, including residential treatment in some cases with people who are really feeling very out of control. They work hard to repatriate the responsibility,
right?
Because people who are lying or people who are hiding anything, really, often that's an indication that there's an integrity problem or there's some deeper injury that really needs to be dealt with and needs to be discussed.
Sure.
Do you typically see sex addiction along with drug addiction co-occurring, or do you see the more independent?
You know, I don't see that much of the co-occurring. I mean, I occasionally, like with alcohol, it might be just the nature of my practice, too. I don't get a whole lot of people who are deep into substance dependence and substance abuse in my practice.
But what about personality disorder? Like, I think bipolar, for sure.
Yeah, and other kinds of personality disorders,
borderline,
too. And that's when you have to ask yourself, is it really compulsive sexual behavior, or is there something deeper that's going
on?
Is it depression? Is it a personality disorder? Is it bipolar disorder? There's actually even some medications that can cause it, like some of the dopamine agonists for Parkinson's.
Yes, I know
somebody.
Yes, and his partner, the gay couple and his partner, was saying, oh, my gosh, well, he's happy as a lark, but he's always in the back room jacking off. I said, you don't get offended by that? He goes, no, I don't care. As long as he comes out and he's smiling, I'm happy. They've been together for over 30 years.
Yeah,
you know?
So
that's so interesting. But I have found that meth addicts often go along with sex addiction. Pornography, you know, it's just like almost like...
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just almost like... have to, I don't know.
The same reward centers in the brain or something. Yeah.
Well, and also the repetitive behavior of clicking and clicking and clicking, I think, is something that meth would lend itself to, you know.
Yeah, and cocaine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh, boy. Right.
So I want to switch topics to the polyamory.
Yes, she's been salivating.
I'm very interested in this. Mm-hmm. Very interested. Okay.
Are you going to talk about this with your husband tonight? Is that what's going to happen? Are you bringing this up?
He'll listen in.
Actually, I had a wonderful consultation with Dr. Beth Leadham, who is our guest today, about this whole issue, because I have a couple where this is has been a high priority. Uh-huh. So she's going to have some great information.
Tell. So, well, first of all, if you can explain to our listeners what the difference is between swinging, I think they're always confused, and polyamory. So maybe you can give a little background.
Yeah, so generally the topic is open relationships or consensual non-monogamy is the term of art, right? And that consensual has to be in there because the data show that about 50% of so-called monogamous marriages involve cheating. Estimates are like 30 to 75% or something.
That's sad.
So we're talking about consensual non-monogamy, and that can range from a so-called hall pass, or somebody saying, you know, what we do when we're traveling for business gets to be private, but when we're together, we're monogamous. It can involve swinging, which is actually a pretty robust community in a lot of our cities and towns, and that involves mostly sex and friendship, all the way to polyamory, negotiated polyamory, which can involve having multiple emotionally committed, emotionally involved love relationships that include some degree of sex.
Oh,
I was just going to say, it seemed to me that in the 70s, when swinging and swapping was very popular, because I remember that was when I was young and my parents were sort of, could overhear them talking about these things on the side, and that all the relationships that I remember of people who were engaged in that ended up getting divorced. So I'm curious, but how does a person actually handle that type of sexual jealousy that emerges, because that's like the deepest of jealousies.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes joke with my boyfriend that we're going to have a research institute that's going to research all these questions, like, because sex research doesn't get any funding anymore.
Oh. And
so things like, you know, are swingers more or less likely to get divorced?
Yes.
That kind of stuff.
We don't know.
So anytime there's an unanswerable question, we always say, it's for the institute to deal with. Someday when we win the lottery, we're going to fund our institute. But the issue of jealousy is a great one. And usually, we don't talk much in this society about jealousy and envy. And they're similar but separate experiences, right? Envy is when somebody has something that you wish you had, you know. Women's magazines are all about envy, right? Yeah. I love that woman's beautiful long eyelashes, and I envy them, and I want to have them for my own, so I'm going to buy the mascara or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Right? And jealousy is about being afraid that something's being taken away from you, right? Typically a relationship. And people who have consensual non-monogamy type relationships have a different relationship to jealousy. We who you know, maybe aren't in that world, experience jealousy as a really painful, really aversive, caustic, extraordinarily difficult feeling, and we want to flee from it. We want to get away from it. It's intolerable. They accept jealousy as part of normal human experience, sort of like the weather. So here comes jealousy. There's a cloud over the sun.
Wow.
Let's just experience it for a while and work it through. Maybe it's got something to tell us, and then it will pass.
Yeah.
There's whole books written on jealousy, and there's a great one called The Jealousy Workbook that I recommend to people who are undertaking an open relationship experiment, where it really looks at, well, when you're jealous, what is that about, and what is it telling you about you, and what it is that you're afraid of losing, and is there actually a threat of losing something, or is this maybe your earlier experience in life associated with losing things resurfacing in this way?
Almost like a transference experience.
Exactly.
Or reenactment.
Totally. But I also think that in these relationships there's accommodation made for, you know, how to help each other handle these experiences. So there may be rules and structures that the couple negotiates for, okay, say we're going to go to a swinging party and we're going to couple up with other people. Well, what do we do before, and what do we do during, and what do we do after that cements our connection and that reassures us that this isn't actually a threat? People who end up doing this successfully typically relationships are all about, is it worth the trouble, right?
Yes.
Is X, Y, or Z worth the trouble, and find that the benefits they get outweigh the difficulties? But really, that is the perennial question. Relationships are a lot of work.
Yeah.
Do most people then grow tired of the polyamory, as if it's just too time-consuming and all that, or once it becomes that sort of quality of life, it's very appealing?
Well, that's a question for the Institute.
Okay.
Because we don't have great longitudinal data.
Open up that Institute!
That's so funny.
In my experience, I mean, I can only talk about my experience, the people who work themselves to a place where they are doing poly or some kind of open relationship, may move in and out of it depending on what circumstances their life is what's happening in their lives, right? So you may have the time and the energy and the wherewithal to negotiate polyamory when you are single and dating, but it may be much more difficult if you've just had twins.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. No, because the twins have each other to play with, so you have plenty of time.
Right.
Just kidding.
And so I want to know, like, what percent of the population do you think is in an open relationship?
Oh, that's a great question. If you're talking about just open relationship, I guess, given the data, it would be 50 or above, right?
Yeah.
If you're talking about consensual,
yeah.
I don't know that we have those data. It's a great question. I don't know
I'm
the
really
answer
curious.
To that one. Yeah.
I remember there was a rumor, like, back in the neighborhood where I lived in Maryland, that, like, if you keep your garage door, like, open a little bit, that means you're, like, a swinger.
It's an invitation.
Isn't that funny?
To crawl under it?
Like, I don't know if it was a rumor or what, but it was just kind of funny.
Yeah. Huh. Well, wasn't that, there was that whole show, too, called Wife Swap and stuff like that?
Yeah.
But I don't know if that was about...
No, Wife Swap is different. No, Wife Swap was, like, when they change wives and they live in each other's houses, but it's not like that.
No, it wasn't.
I don't think they were swapping that.
No,
they were
exactly.
not. Oh,
no,
they were not having sex.
But there is something, there was something on, like, HBO about, like, swingers.
Uh-huh.
Like real sex and swingers or something like that. And they did documentary on that.
You know, it's a really interesting topic. It's getting a lot of play and a lot of press. Mm-hmm. And in the big urban centers, there is a growing community of people who are developing community connections. So here in Los Angeles, there's a big polyamory community, San Francisco, New York.
Yeah. I have to tell you this, like, you know how certain experiences in life, like, they're indelible in your brain and you can't get them out? So I think I was only 15 years old. And, you know, of course, we drove cars we weren't supposed to drive without driver's licenses and went to clubs and had fake IDs and all those things. If anybody needs to arrest me, I think it's beyond the statute of limitations. But anyway, so my sister and her friend got a hold of some invitation to this party that was up in one of the Gabor's houses. And they had like a limo that you park your car at the bottom and it pulls, you take, go up to the top and all this stuff is like, you know, it's like walking on the set of The Bachelorette, right? It's all like perfect and beautiful and all this stuff. So we walk in and I'm like, you know, have a cocktail and talking to some people who are significantly older than I am. And I had to go to the bathroom. Oh, so I'm walking down the hall and I'm thinking this is the bathroom. And I open up this door and it's an orgy.
Oh,
it's a full-fledged orgy. I saw more humping and bumping than I've ever seen in my
whole... You were 15?
I think I was 15. I might have even been a little bit younger. It was, you know, it was kind of traumatizing and also very curious.
Of course.
All these people were naked and, you know, the couples and... in, you know, just everywhere, lying on couches and floors and all that stuff. I was like, okay, well, I guess that's something I have to look forward to. I mean, like, we didn't have any sex education at that time, so I was like,
wow,
that's what it's about. Okay.
So, and I bet it didn't look like a porn version of an orgy, did it?
No.
It was decidedly less glamorous.
Yes, right. there were no beautiful makeup, perfect boobs standing up. Nope.
No, nothing. I was thinking of the movie
curious.
Eyes Wide Shut, too.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see
movie.
That. But it was very red. Now, that wasn't blood, but there was a lot of red, like, carpet. That's what I remember.
Really?
Like, red carpet and red couches. And, sort of like a bad pizza parlor.
So funny.
Anyway, that was just a side note. Yes, we do like to share some of our
personal experiences.
Our old experiences. Yeah, so, all right. So, some people would say that polyamory is sanctioned cheating. Yes, so maybe you could speak to the difference about that. The consensual versus non-consensual.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think certainly for people who hold monogamy as an ideal or as a religious value, it's definitely going to feel like that kind of violation, no matter who's agreeing to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think people who are interested in poly or in open relationships are acknowledging the multiple difficulties associated with maintaining monogamy over a long-term relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot, you know, long-term relationships are wonderful and satisfying and also challenging in a lot of ways. For many, sexual desire drops off. For many, there are compromises that come up, you know, inevitably when you're talking about making a life with someone. And also sometimes somebody gets sick, somebody's sex drive falls off the table for one reason or another, and that has to be accommodated for.
Or menopause.
Sure. I see a lot of that. especially when I look in the mirror. So yeah, so I think it really is the question of, is it negotiated and is everyone getting something out of it? And it's important to think about what the principles are that are organizing poly. The people I know who are doing poly are very focused on foundational principles that really support relationships, like integrity and honesty and supporting each other in being individuals. Those are values that underpin many kind of healthy relationships. It's not just we want to go have a lot of fun. Although there are some people who do that, typically more the swingers than the poly people, because maintaining polyamory is really difficult. It requires a lot of communication and a lot of maintenance.
Thinking it's a lot hard of processing. One relationship.
But I know, right? Imagine that one of the biggest fears, the jealousy part, is that your partner is going to actually fall in love with someone else, maybe beyond what or she has with you. And that would be just, I think, devastating. You walk in with the intention that we're both going to just have more fulfilling things, but we're still the core couple. And then all of a sudden, it's like, you know, it's like the affair when somebody leaves their spouse for the affair. You know, what? How do you deal with that?
I don't think that would happen that often, but correct me if I'm wrong, because I think you're going into it like, hey, we both sort of want this. If it's consensual and they both agree to it.
Well, it's interesting. There's a there's an ideal in polyamory called compersion. Are you familiar with that term? That's when someone feels happy at their partner's happiness in another relationship. They're experiencing vicarious joy in that way. The ideal is in is sort of replacing jealousy. And if you can get to a place of compersion, then that's really a wonderful place to be, if you can really be truly happy in that way. And what that means is that there is an acceptance that there will be ebbing and flowing of attachments, and that you can maybe have a shift in your attachment with your primary partner, but that that is okay because that's an inevitable part of relationships. It's really a different, it's really, these people are really negotiating in a different relationship with certain types of feelings than those of us in monogamous relationships. Different relationship with jealousy, different relationship with possessiveness, and really aspiring to have a different set of experiences.
One of the things that I have encountered that was really challenging for these people is that, so they both agreed to enter into this polyamory agreement, you know, all that, every sorted out the boundaries and the rules and all that. And then one of them regretted doing that and felt really bad about it and didn't want a partner to continue on. But that it's like it had been opened up and didn't want to stop. So
yeah, that's what lands people in my office a lot of times.
Yeah, I would imagine. That's
because
so
you have to, you know, I tell people when they're trying to set up, and there is a right way and a wrong way to do this. The wrong way to do it is just kind of jump in and figure it out later.
Right.
Because you have to prepare for the reality that you're going to have unexpected experiences.
Yeah.
It's like with any new thing in life.
Right.
You don't know how you're going to feel until you're really in it. And it does often happen when somebody has an unexpected kind of experience and wants to pull back, and they realize, oh, wait, we forgot to negotiate this or that thing.
The what if.
What if, and uh-oh, there, you know, the wrench got thrown into something, and, you know, I didn't think to negotiate with you about whether it was okay if you had a partner who had herpes, for example. But now you have a partner with herpes, and then does that put me at risk, and how am I going to handle that, and am I really okay with that? So often what we end up doing is really pulling back and renegotiating foundationally. And sometimes, you know, it's consensual non-monogamy, so people are free to withdraw their consent. That's fundamental to consent.
Right.
I see. So then what about the partner who doesn't want to withdraw consent? Do you encourage that partner to do so? Or?
Well, then you've got a lot of couples therapy to do, right?
Yeah. Or the case where, like, somebody is gets luckier than the other one, so to speak. You know, where you both agree and you go, like, I'm hot. I mean, I can get anybody I want.
And like, the other partner.
The other one's, like, going out every night. It's like, wait a minute. What am I, chump change or chopped liver?
That's
interesting.
Right, which then introduces envy, right? Envy their partner, their partner's success.
Not even just jealousy there,
It's all grist for the mill. But in a way, if you think about it, that's not a whole lot different from, say, a big marital conflict when somebody has a job offer in another city and they really want to take it.
Right.
And the partner doesn't want to uproot his or her life and the children and everything else. That's a kind of a crisis, right? And you've got to really do some intensive work to resolve the crisis.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And sometimes people do break up.
Right. Just curious how much of the fantasy is the reality. So I think a lot of people fantasize about this or fantasize about threesomes or swinging, and it's like, oh, it'd be so great and everything. And then I'm curious, like, what the reality is like. Like, wow, what is it usually what people expected? You know, and you can't answer that, but I'm just curious, you know?
It's just I mean, it's hard for me because people come to me when it's not going well.
Ah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
That's true, huh?
Yeah.
But I do find a lot of times the aspiration and the fantasy doesn't really match the reality because people have feelings that are hard and they're not pleasant, and it's really hard work to work through them. And then you get into this territory of, well, if I've got a feeling that's a legitimate feeling, do I really want to talk myself out of my feeling?
Yeah.
If I have jealousy, aren't I entitled to jealousy, or do I really have to fight it? And if you think about jealousy, we kind of come by it honestly as organisms. I mean, there are reasons why, evolutionary reasons why we would want to keep our partner to ourselves.
Sure. Makes sense.
So evolutionarily, speaking of that, are we more designed as a population to be monogamous or poly?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Is this an institute question?
No, there is some great research from anthropology and history. There's a great book called Sex at Dawn, if you ever want to take a look at. It's a bit controversial. Some of the conclusions have been disputed by some people in academia, but it kind of goes through a lot of the research and history on how societies have functioned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the exceptions to monogamy are more numerous than you would think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even in so-called monogamous species, mm-hmm. other than humans, there are violations of monogamy.
Uh-huh. Is that ducks? Ducks?
Well, no, penguins.
Penguins, certain types of birds, like a lot of birds there
mate
for life.
For life, do too. They? Yeah. I thought so, yeah.
So there certainly have been societies in which monogamy wasn't held up as the ideal, or at least as a permanent ideal, where mm-hmm. things would shift. Nevertheless, marriage has been a pretty sturdy institution for recorded history, mm-hmm. right? So is it ingrained? Is it not? It's really hard to tell. The reality is we are where we are, mm-hmm. and we have the values that we have, and we kind of got to work with what we have.
Also seems like it's kind of unreasonable to expect the statistics on divorce to not just continue to increase. Our lives are so much longer now. So you marry somebody at 25 and you're going to be with them for 60 years? I mean, can you imagine waking up to David in 60 years? Just kidding. David's awesome.
It's a long time.
It's awesome. But I mean, it's like, it's to some degree, it just seems like it's unrealistic. Like, I mean, when you're a teenager, I mean, I cycled through relationships like every 6 weeks.
Right.
Love lost. Oh, my God, I'm dying. Oh, there you are. You're cute. You know, I mean,
right. It just, absolutely.
You know, we didn't expect when you meet somebody at 15 that you're going to marry them. And, you know, it happens. But, geez. So a lot of people are going to go through, just like they say, we're sort of destined to have 3 to 5 careers these days mm-hmm. because of our longevity.
Sure.
Well, maybe it's more reasonable to think that whoever we marry in our 20s.
Yeah.
And raise kids with. I mean, like, I don't think people who raise kids together should stay together.
Yeah, I know somebody says we should have 2 partners, one that we have children with, and the second one that we have for fun.
Oh, yeah. My God, that's really true. That's really funny.
But, you know, it's also interesting because we're in a culture right now where we expect a lot of our spouses.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we expect them to be our best friend and our co-parent mm-hmm. and our business partner a lot of the time, and our house partner mm-hmm. and our confidant.
Yes.
And our therapists and whatever else we expect these people to be. And it's kind of unique. I mean, it wasn't like this throughout history. You go back 100 years and that was not the expectation.
No, he was the provider and she was the homemaker, by and large.
If you keep your expectations low, you're not going to get disappointed, right?
That is true. That is true. So what do you think is reasonable to expect of a spouse?
Oh, that's a great question.
Institute or you?
Oh, well.
Your opinion, please, Dr. Beth.
Well, I think for me, you know, and what I tell my patients is that you have to have reasonable expectations. You have to expect your partner to be who he or she is. Mm-hmm. And you can't get in, as we all know, you can't get into a relationship intending to change somebody, or else you're just going to end up being frustrated and mm-hmm. harming the other person. I think it's reasonable to certainly expect companionship and love and sex. Right? But I also think it's reasonable to expect some privacy. So I do believe in being able to have some aspect of private life. And
you mean as individuals?
Just as an individual, and have private thoughts. I don't share every little thing I think about my partner with my partner.
Sure.
He doesn't need to hear some of that stuff.
Right.
That's what your best friend's for. Yeah.
You know, or therapist or whatever. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I always grapple with that issue, the difference between privacy and secrecy. Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty monogamous person, by and large. I mean, that's just, I'm sort of wired that way, and that's what I want, and that's what I expect of my partner, so I don't think we'll ever be having the polyamory conversation, and I think he is too. But
and
I,
that's beautiful. Being monogamous is beautiful. If the,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Both people are committed to it.
But I've come to understand, I think, a lot more in my career and just as a growing woman to understand the complexity of human sexuality, mm-hmm. and that everybody's not wired the same way, and so that, I mean, I don't really have any judgments about it,
sure.
except for when people are dishonest, mm-hmm. and, you know, they're being, mm-hmm. they're cheating. I mean, that just is not okay
right.
in a relationship, in my opinion. But in terms of, you know, it's a hard one for me to answer. I mean, I know that people fantasize, but I do have some of that, I guess, sort of ingrained in me that you can also change fantasy. You can have a thought, but you don't have to necessarily engage in the thought for very long, you know? So we do have some control over that. So if, mm-hmm. you know, if you're having sex with your partner and an image of someone else pops up, you can either go with that image,
uh-huh.
or you could actually turn your attention back to your partner. So that's where I have some difficulty, is when, for me personally, if,
sure.
if my partner were just running down that road, but I may be unrealistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of couples that I end up seeing are in what I call the untenable position. And here's what that looks like. It's often a man and a woman, and they come in, and her sex drive has fallen off the table for one reason or another. She just doesn't want to have sex anymore. Maybe she never really liked it in the first place. Maybe there was never that much attraction. Mm-hmm, whatever. Fill mm-hmm. in the blank for the reason. But he still has a healthy sex drive. He still
sure.
wants to have sex. And she is saying, I am not willing to have sex, which, of course, we don't want to force unwanted
yeah.
sex on somebody. That's non-consensual. But she's saying, I'm not willing to have sex anymore, but you can't either because you're monogamous with me.
Mm. Yeah, that's
an untenable
fair.
Position,
yes,
and that
I
is
agree.
Asking a partner yeah. to cut off, to amputate a healthy limb, basically.
I agree. Uh-huh.
There has to be some solution to that.
Sure.
You know, and it's interesting because I think a lot of affairs are actually strategies to stay married, where somebody is in that position
uh-huh.
and
mm-hmm.
they decide, okay, I'm just going to outsource this little thing.
Outsource. Yes. I like that.
It's true.
Because I want to stay married yeah. to my partner. I love my partner, but there's this thing I just can't live with.
Right.
So I'm going to put it over here, and then it gets mm-hmm. discovered. And my metaphor for that is when you throw red paint on a cluttered garage, all anyone can see is red paint. They can't see the mess underneath. It's
right.
kind of like all anybody can see is the infidelity
right.
and not
sure.
the issues.
And not the underneath, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we only have a few more minutes left, but I'm curious if you've realized that women and men have affair for different reasons in your experience.
Mm, that's interesting.
Like, is it what they normally say, that women, you know, need more of that emotional and they're not getting it from their partner? Or is it...
You know, I see both.
Yeah.
On both
yeah.
sides. I see men who are having affairs because they feel unappreciated and mm-hmm. undervalued and are really seeking
yeah.
a type of emotional connection that they feel isn't available for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or are doing it for sexual
sure.
reasons. And the same with women who may feel like they picked their husband because that person would be a great father and is a decent, you
mm-hmm.
know, upstanding person that they can really admire but never really had the hots for.
Yeah.
And,
sure.
you know, that may seem like a reasonable decision early on when you're picking a husband,
mm-hmm.
but later on, boy, it'll come and bite you in the butt.
Yes. Yes.
yes.
And so frequently there's a sense of having been sexually unfulfilled and really wanting to experience
sure.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Such
so,
important information.
So interesting.
So, Dr. Beth Leedham, where can people find you?
Oh, they can find me online. I'm at drbethleedham.com. That's drbethleedham.com.
Yes.
And they can call me at 818-254-5554.
Okay.
So articulate.
Yeah. This is great. This is great. I know we didn't even get to all the questions
oh my
that
God.
We had, but...
This is,
we'll have you on again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to come. Thank
yeah,
you. This is fun.
Absolutely. So, very exciting. Next
yes.
week, we're actually having Tiffany Luptak,
yes.
who happens to be my daughter. She is coming on to talk about all of her new discoveries and wisdom in Ayurveda medicine and various different yoga practices and herbs. And
she's just a wonderful person. Like,
she,
I just have to say that. Not just because she's your daughter.
I say it. You keep
Zip
saying it.
But, like, she really is. She's just a kind soul, and I just love her energy. And even through her emails, she's just so sweet and... So, you know, aside from that whole thing, I'm just excited to
yes,
have her on personally.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you, everybody, for listening. And
thank you so much.
Yeah.
Oh, my
thank
God.
You
what
for
a great
me.
Show.
What a great show.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
All right, see you guys next time.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.